Upon the Temple Mount there stands an awesome monument, with its golden dome shining in the sun, visible from everywhere you go. Take any photograph you care to take of the holy city, and there is the Dome of the Rock, a tribute to the once supreme dominance of Islam, and to its persistence in spite of its at least temporary decay. A tribute to the occasion when a building formerly there was burnt down and then reft apart stone by stone, till nothing stood of the temple which they called Herod's Temple. Itself a milestone in a long, long history, beginning, as far as we are concerned, when Abraham heard the words, "Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, and go to Mount Moriah and offer him there for a burnt sacrifice." And upon whatever altar may have stood there, Abraham erected what was needful to sacrifice his son, and raised the knife to slay him. And only by the angelic word that told him to withdraw his hand, for God had provided himself a sacrifice, was Isaac spared, and Abraham's faith, ready to believe that God was able to raise Isaac from the dead, not put so far to the test. But in principle, a chosen son was slain there that day, and in principle raised again. What they did on Mount Moriah after Abraham's and Melchizedek's day, I do not know, but there came a time when King David spied the threshing ground of Araunah the Jebusite and bought it, and there by divine direction prepared the time for the day when his son, his immediate son, Solomon, would erect a house according to the pattern that God had provided to King David himself. And that was the end of a long period of history. History which, as far as we are concerned, had begun when, as Stephen puts it, the God of our fathers called Abraham from Ur of the Chaldees, and as we know of our Haran, and then down the Jordan Valley into the Promised Land. Went on as the dweller in tents, moved hither and thither, from Israel to Egypt and back, as the moods of the weather required of him, and the friendship or hostility of his neighbours, until the time came when his wife died, and he sought a burial place for her. And the inhabitants of the land, who were not Abraham's children, but the Hittites, bargained with him, seemingly willing to give away a valuable piece of property, and accepting from him, ultimately, what was doubtless at least, if not more, than its full worth. And there Abraham buried his wife, and later was buried himself. And the son of his promise continued his wanderings, worshipping God where he might. And the grandson of promise moved, following his son Joseph, into a place of exile, where, for some hundreds of years, they who were still faithful to their God worshipped him too, as well they might, in whatever circumstances were permitted to them. There was, that we know about, no tabernacle, perhaps no tent of any kind, maybe just the improvised building of an altar, as Abraham had done, where God was pleased to be worshipped for as long as they remembered to worship him. By the time of Moses, that memory had grown dim and thin. So weak was their recollection of the grace that God had shown to their fathers, that Moses called at the burning bush, envisaged that when he went to the people to tell them about their true God, they would say, "What is his name?" and need to be told again what Abraham had so clearly known. Not until they went into the wilderness was there established for God a recognizable, unique place of worship, built, as we have read, exactly according to those dimensions and forms and materials that God had revealed to Moses in the mount. There they built their box-like structure, 30 cubits by 10 by 10, and set a court around it. And the structure itself was divided into a holy place and a yet more holy place, the one twice the length of the other. And in the most holy place, they set the ark, the mercy seat, the cherubim above upon it, and erected it to stand where only priests might go, and in the holy place only the high priest, to carry out the morning and evening, week by week, monthly, three times annual, and the annual Day of Atonement, feasts of the Lord. They took it with them when they went towards the Holy Land. And when they went within, doubtless under Joshua's direction, himself under the hand of God, took it further inside the promised land, west of Jordan, and set it up. It seems they set it, ultimately, if not immediately, in Shiloh, in the state of Ephraim. And there it remained, more or less, until the time came when a new and more stable state of affairs was to take its place. All was not stable, even at Shiloh. Dreadful things went on in the courts there. The sons of priests committed fornication in the holy places. The sacrifices were defiled by the frames of mind of those who carried them out when their hearts were elsewhere. The crowning indignity to that tabernacle of the congregation, or tent of meeting as it is better called, tent at which God met his people, was when, engaged in bitter warfare against the apparently triumphant Philistines, they resolved that the ark was the thing to be taken to lead them to victory. So, violating all the precepts required for the sanctified keeping of that box of the covenant to which the two tables of stone had been placed, they took it with them against the enemy. And the enemy took it from them. Took it from them and found it too hot to keep. Suffered such pains and indignities that he made haste to take it back again. And so the Philistines, placing the ark upon the cart, led by the lowing oxen, brought it back to Beth Shemesh, and then later to Kiriath Jearim in Judah. There the ark stayed, for decades at least. Whereas the tabernacle which had held it, of that there's a dotted line in history where we can but speculate as to what occurred. It was there in Shiloh, it seems, when they removed the ark from it. It was not, it seems, there in Shiloh when they brought the ark back. The ark was not then or ever taken back into the tabernacle at Shiloh in Ephraim. And when we inquire where the tabernacle was all that time, well, all that time we do not know, but we do know that when Solomon went to it, it was not at Shechem anymore, or Shiloh rather, it was at Gibeah in Benjamin. And how it came to be moved from the one place to the other again, we do not know, but may legitimately guess. When Jeremiah, in his 7th chapter, warns the people against trusting in their extant temple where such evil things were done and such evil hearts were congregated, he said, "Remember what I did unto Shiloh." And again, "Beware lest I do unto this house as I did unto Shiloh." Something had gone on in Shiloh which is unrecorded for us. We are left speculatively to fill in the gaps. And the very tentative conclusion to which I would come is that when the Philistines had conquered Israel, they made short work of the place where its shrine had been. And faced with the sacking of the city, faithful Israelites quickly gathered together the tabernacle and took it away. Levites, no doubt they were. And put it up somewhere in a place of safety. And there it was, in Solomon's day, in the state of Benjamin. That true ark and that true tabernacle never met again, When David removed the ark from Kiriath-Jearim, he set up a special tent for it, but it was not the old tent, it was some new provisional temporary place of residence, till a more permanent place could be found. It was found in Solomon's day. It took 7 years to erect. It had the same shape, horizontally at least, as the tabernacle had had, but was doubled in its dimensions, still divided into its holy place and its one-half-sized most holy place. And into that last they put the ark, again to find a resting place. The ark which had been taken from Shiloh, captured by the Philistines, returned in haste, housed in blessed homes for some short period till David took it back into official custody, was then placed in the new most holy place, in the house made of stones and timber and gold. We know what it contained. There was nothing in the ark save the two tables of stone that Moses had received in Horeb and had caused to be put there. And if you say, weren't there at one time more things than that in the ark? Well, it's a little matter for question whether they were all inside or whether the other ones were by the side of, but at least they were all in the most holy place. The ark first, its tables of stone within, and either within or close by, the golden pot of manna that had been assembled during the miraculous feeding of the people in the wilderness, and Aaron's rod that budded when the people rebelled against their God. That the historian in First Book of Kings should say there was nothing in the ark save the two tables of stone does at least, however, create the presumption that by this time the golden pot of manna had disappeared. Its gold perhaps looted, its manna by now corrupted. That which, unlike the rest of the manna, had withstood the passage of time and survived uncorrupted without breeding worms, as that which Israel left had done, had now disappeared. One symbol of God's friendship with his people, one token of his care and feeding of them, had vanished and was never seen again. Aaron's rod that budded had gone too, we must presume. Whether it had been inside the ark or by the side of it is, I think, almost neither here nor there. For had it been present when they re-established the ark in Solomon's most holy place, then surely there would have been reference to it. So the rod that budded had, I presume, gone too. Insignificant losses, you might think. Yet God had used that rod as a token of his favour upon the then priesthood as against those who would have usurped the place. And that evidence too of God's intimate concern with the well-being of his people had vanished from the earth. The bread of life had gone in symbol, and so had the living proof of God's sprouting presence with his burgeoning people. There was the ark left, made of wood and gold, and the covenant, made of stone. Dead things in their substance. The living things had gone. Not living in their contents were they the subject of a living faith, for none who kept the Ten Commandments faithfully could be any other than quickened by the precepts it required of them. But when in the letter to the Hebrews, in the portion that we have read and that follows afterwards, we learn that the first tabernacle did have the most holy place, in which there was the ark, and in which there was also the golden pot of manna and Aaron's rod that budded, it would seem that Hebrews is telling us that things had changed since those days. That the tabernacle, for all its temporary materials, was richer than the temple had been. That the wandering shrine that Moses had caused to be built was fuller of the presence of God than anything that Solomon could put together, great though Solomon's temple, more glorious than anything seen before, had been. Solomon's temple too had vanished. They had torn it down and taken away its most holy things. Nebuchadnezzar, systematic man that he was, had made a tally of all the things he took away, and you knew them, if they were worth weighing, by number and by count and by weight. Some of them survived to be used impiously by Belshazzar, successor to Nebuchadnezzar. Some of them were there to be taken back and used again in the most holy rites when Cyrus gave permission for Jews to go back somewhere in the 6th century before Christ. And so they rebuilt the temple. How well rebuilt? How comparable in glory with the temple that Solomon had built, we may not know, save that there were those who saw it old enough to have seen the former one, and they wept. But perhaps they wept for joy. Or again, perhaps they wept for the sense of precariousness that overhung their life when they saw how easily the blessed things that God had brought about could be put away again, and how quickly God's presence could be removed and the people proved unworthy of it. But they did have a temple again. And what did they put in it? As far as I know, we are not told. That the most holy place, they would have had a most holy place, contained anything that could be called an ark, I do not know. And if it did, well, whether that ark had anything continuous with the ark that had been there when Solomon caused it to be placed in that most holy place, I do not know. It looks as though the second temple had no ark within it, such as God had blessed and caused Moses to build. They spent a long time making that temple look almost other than it was, so that when we speak of Herod's temple, we speak of it as though it was a new temple again, though it would seem from the little I know about it that it was in fact the survival of the temple of Haggai and Zechariah, made more glorious by the 46 years of labour that Herod, who called himself King of the Jews, had caused to be bestowed upon it. And wonderful it was. "Master, see what stones and what manner of precious things are these," they said to him. All were united in viewing it with reverence. Faithful Jews, even disciples. In some ways, the Lord himself, who, casting out the changes of money and the sellers of expensive sacrifices, said, "Make not my father's house a house of merchandise," took the temple of Herod's day to be a temple which God was willing to receive as his own. But what did that temple contain? Its external courts, its barriers beyond which no Gentile might go on pain of death, its holy place and its most holy place, its heavy, very heavy, embroidered veil separating the one from the other. But what they had inside that veil again, I do not know, but it seems most unlikely that it could have been the earliest ark that Moses had caused to be made. And almost certain that it did not contain the golden pot of manna, or Aaron's rod that budded. More splendid than ever before. More magnificent perhaps even than Solomon's temple, the outside had been. Herod's temple was a temple where there was only the shell of the divine observance. And the holy things had long since gone away. Priests there were, of course. High priests too. But even they had failed to continue that which had been laid down by God through Moses, that the high priest should be Aaron and then his eldest surviving son and then his eldest surviving son throughout the generations. Now they had a household of priests from whom brothers in their turn could be selected by the permission of the Romans to occupy the priestly office. And no longer as the ancient law of primogeniture observed, where elder son succeeded elder son. Much that had dignified the tabernacle, the humble tabernacle of Moses' day, had been lost beyond repair when the Jews so glorified the temple that remained to them in Jesus' day, concerning which the Lord said, "There shall not one stone be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." And then they had no temple. And then there was a bare mound, and upon that bare mound, in course of time, there came to be erected what was at least to the Jews an abomination of desolation. And there was the Mosque of Omar, the Dome of the Rock, the inescapable first thing you see when you look at the pictures of Jerusalem today. And the Temple of Israel has gone. And the priests have gone. I do not know whether in the inner circles of the Jewish archivists they know for sure who their Levites are and who their priests are. But as far as I am concerned, you take it as probable that if a man bears the name of Cohen, then probably somewhere in his ancestry was a priest. And he himself of priestly descent. For Kohen is the Jewish word for priest. But the glory is gone. The age of the threshing floor is back as far as the Jews are concerned. There is a western wall against which they can knock their heads in vain devotions and worship if they weep not as they used to weep and hope for things to come. It is perhaps that varying fate of the tabernacles that took the place, the temples that took the place of the tabernacle, that leads the letter to the Hebrews, when it is discussing the old-fashioned ordinances, to concentrate on tabernacle and ignore the temple. It took the place which God had ordained through Moses with all its glorious things, with its holy places and its sacrifices and its mercy seat and its cherubim and its ark and its pot of manna and its Aaron's rod that budded. That was the glory of things as they used to be, and if they had not gone already, as most of them have, they were about to go. The Lord had spoken of their going without apparent regret. "Destroy this temple," he said, "and in 3 days I will raise it up." And when they, either in misunderstanding or in mockery, said, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou raise it up in 3 days? John tells us, and perhaps the Lord told them, that he spoke of the temple of his body. But they chose to regard Jesus as a blasphemer. They remembered his words against him. What he had said that day of the first cleansing of the temple, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will build it up," became something for them to remember and to distort and to quote in evidence against him. And so when the Lord stood trial for his life before them, and they already determined upon his destruction, thought to find legal reasons that they could write down as the ground of his condemnation, one of the things they said against him was, "This man said, 'I am able to destroy this place and to build it again in 3 days.' That man had not said that. He had never said, 'I am able to destroy this temple and to build it up.' He had said, 'You destroy this temple, and I will build it up.' The temple was to be destroyed by their act, or by the Romans, and the two were intimately linked. In physical fact, the Romans burnt it and pulled it down. In spiritual fact, the Jews destroyed it and pulled it down. Their glorification of Mammon in its courts, their sale for profit of nominally clean animals for sacrifice to people who could not afford to buy, their making of the Father's house a den of thieves, spelled the destruction of the temple in which they worshipped. When Jeremiah, whom I have quoted already in his 7th chapter, warned them against the iniquities they were practicing in the last days of the kings, he warned them that if they did not repent, then God would do with this house as he had done with Shiloh. And we have already speculated what he had done with Shiloh. So the Romans merely performed a demolition job upon a house already condemned when they knocked the temple down. The Jews had already determined its fate. "Behold, as the Lord said to them, your house is left unto you desolate." It was not without pain that the Lord spoke such and similar words. Despised though the temple was in the eyes of those who worshipped falsely there, it was still the residue of the place which God had set aside in the city which he had chosen to be worshipped in. And when the Lord saw that and thought of its fate, he wept and mourned. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that slayest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thee and kept thee as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings? But ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. I wonder whether perhaps when the disciples came to Jesus that day of the Olivet prophecy and pointed out the temple to him and lavished their loving praise upon its wonders and said to him, Master, behold what wonderful things, whether they were not themselves remembering the Lord's doom and saying, Lord, couldn't you spare it? May it not still stand in spite of everything? And hearing the Lord's implacable, no, it must be pulled down stone by stone. Pulled down it was, and nothing remained. There had been until fairly recently two temples in the Promised Land. One in Gerizim where the Samaritans were, and one in Jerusalem where the Jews under the Romans were dominant. And the Jews had seen to it that the Romans knocked down the Samaritan temple. So that when the woman of Samaria came to Jesus and said, Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, would ye say that in Jerusalem men ought to worship? She was referring to the ashes of the temple they had once known, where Samaritans worshipped, as they partly understood him, some element of the truth about the one true God. Jesus' answer to her gave no hope for the fallen temple in Gerizim, and not much more for the still existing temple in Jerusalem. The hour is coming, he said, when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall men worship God, for God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. As Gerizim had gone, so Jerusalem must go, and then there would be nothing left. Well, nothing left except that great thing left, which the Apostle Paul wrote about when he said, Ye are the temple of the living God. As God hath said, I will dwell in them, and I will walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Not nothing at all, but something greater and better. As they had misrepresented the Lord at his trial, so they did Stephen at his. We have heard him say, they said about Stephen, that Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and shall change the customs that Moses had delivered unto us. In the latter, they might have been partly right. But as to the former, unless Stephen had not got right the words of his Lord, which we do not believe, then they had not heard Stephen say that. What they had heard Stephen say, doubtless, is that Jesus of Nazareth was to provide a system of worship in which this place would have lost its part, and all faithful people from whatever race would come together to worship the Lord in spirit and in truth, and as we sing, wherever, Lord, thy people meet, there they behold the mercy seat. But they were able to use it in Stephen's condemnation too. It made no difference that Stephen could, in a way we have cited already, call attention to the many years in times past where God had been very happy to be worshipped without the use of a temple, as with wandering Abraham, and Israel in Egypt, and Moses in the pre-tabernacle wilderness, and indeed even in tabernacle days when the temple as such had not been built. It did not placate them that Stephen was able to tell them that Solomon's temple could only have been a symbol of divine habitation. You can't take a box that big and put within it a god that big. The Most High dwelleth not in temples made with hands. The heaven, even the heaven of heavens, cannot contain him. So where is the house that he will build me, and where is the place of my rest? God had said. It was always a kind of idolatry if men supposed for a moment that God, who could become present in the temple, could be found nowhere else. For God, as we say in our creeds, is everywhere present by his Spirit. It did not help Stephen's case either. When describing the infinity of God, not to be contained within a box, however beautiful, went on to take the words of the prophet, and instead of commending to his people that to God to this man will I look, to him that is of a contrite and an humble spirit, and that trembleth at my word, denounced their opposite spirit, and said, ye stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, ye do always resist the Holy Spirit, as your fathers did, so do ye. It was at that point that they stopped their ears, that they ran upon him and took him outside their city, and in defiance of all the laws of God and men, lynched him there and then. But they had double-sealed now the fate of their ordinances. They who, having rejected the Master, treated his followers the same, had no hope that their special standing in God's sight would be allowed to survive, then or for a long time to come. So all was lost. Were it not for the Lord's words, they that worship him shall worship him in spirit and in truth. Or his promise, other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, that there may be one flock, one shepherd. Or his assurance that the faithful of the Lord do not depend for their standing in his sight upon their standing within or near to a temple made with hands. The solid things, the rock foundation, the unhewn stone, the gold coverings, the artifacts of skilled and cunning men, these were the solid things in which they trusted. But the whole picture of the letter to the Hebrews and other places is that what we can see does not represent the ultimate reality. That this meeting place is not a more evident token of the existence of God than if we met in the open air without a wall around us. The Most High dwelleth not in the temple made with hands. And what much of the New Testament exists to show is that the worship of God needs to be translated from the barely material into the solidly spiritual of the things of God. While, as Paul puts it, we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal. The things which are not seen are eternal. If we take those words of Paul, which refer in the first instance to the fact that he was not afraid to die, and didn't view with any terror the dissolution of this mortal body, and make them general about the things of God, then Paul is saying the reality of something in God's sight is not to be determined by how much it weighs, or how bright it shines, or what its dimensions are. All those things can pass away, even the gold. But the thing which persists is that which is in the sight of God of great value and of great price, and those are the eternal things, Paul says. It is unto us as heirs of these eternal things that this message of shadow and substance is directed. When we talk about the meaning of the atonement, when we discussed the importance of the death of Christ, a topic we don't discuss enough, or with sufficient depth of understanding, we are apt to start where Israel started, with its sacrifices, and its priests, and its tabernacle, and its most holy place, and its shedding of blood. Not wrong to start with those things. That was the way Israel started. That was historically the way it developed. That would no doubt have been the way in which the earlier preachers of the gospel tried to bring the Jews of their day to see that these things were leading to something better and were not ends in themselves. But we will, in the talks that follow, if God be willing, seek to show a way which to Gentile minds is easier to apprehend and gives to a fuller understanding. We may say, God laid down as a law, and he certainly laid down as a fact, that without the shedding of blood there is no remission of sins. And so we say, there can't be an atonement unless blood is shed. And then we add, but the blood of bulls and of goats was not a voluntary offering. They were taken, they were slain, their blood was taken from them. They did not offer it. There was no willingness in what bulls and goats and lambs and turtle doves provided for sacrifice. They were tokens co-opted by men under the command of God to reveal something greater that lay behind. And Hebrews, bringing it out, takes the words that without the shedding of blood there is no remission of sin and offers a complementary proposition, which is, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and of goats to take away sin. So where Moses said you can't do it without the shedding of blood, Hebrews says you can't even do it with. What is impossible without sacrifice is equally impossible with sacrifice, left to itself. The significance of sacrifice lies in where it points, in the perception of faithful offerers as to where it points, in what it leads to, rather than in what it is. A man is no more near to salvation because blood has just been shed than he was before it had happened, unless his mind perceives at least something of what lies behind the shedding of the blood. It's not for nothing that when the Lord refers to his own death, he relates it to the earliest death by violence that the scriptures contain, and says to his enemies that they should slay him as they had slain the prophets before him, that the blood of all the righteous men shed from the foundation of the world might be required of this generation, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zacharias, the son of Barachias, whom they would slay between the temple and the altar. We don't really know the history of the latter too well. There are two or three historical episodes that might be fit into it, but about Abel we know very well. He and his brother came to offer sacrifice to their God, and the one brought vegetable matter and the other brought living matter, animal living matter. And Cain's vegetables were rejected, and Abel's animal sacrifice was received. And Cain in his anger lifted up his hand against his brother and slew him. And the voice of his brother's blood cried from the ground, cried for justice against Cain, who cried with a voice of promise in favour of Abel's spiritual children. We are come, Hebrews tells us, to blood that speaketh better things than that of Abel. Abel died murdered, but he died as a vigorous token of a sacrifice yet to be made. He was, in the fullest sense, a type of his Lord who was to follow. All sacrifices of all faithful people, as well as all sacrifices of all clean animals, from the beginning of the promises of God to the end, would find their culmination when they took the Lord Jesus Christ and slew him. The blood by itself meant nothing. Take the most holy sacrifice the Jews were allowed to perform. Go to the great day of atonement, which took place once each year, and see, looking at it one way, the greatness of that occasion. Then the high priest might go very close to his God, closer than at any other time, that he might go, not without blood, into the most holy place and receive sanctification for his people, and, we presume, come out and proclaim words of blessing from within the most holy. There in the earliest days the imminent glory of God had shone. Even now, where the glory had departed, the symbol was there. The priest went that day very close to God. But Hebrews takes the sanctuary and not makes light of it exactly, but makes great play of its limitations. That day the priest might go into the most holy place, the glorifiers of the day would say. What about the other 364 days? The apostle would say. Only one day. For the rest the most holy place was closed. In such a way does Hebrews cut us down to size and make us see what the Day of Atonement could and could not do, and tell us it revealed the inaccessibility of God more than his availability. The door was closed nearly all the time. It opened a chink just one day a year. Moreover, into that holy place, says Hebrews, went the high priest alone. Only one man might go near to him. Not even the high priest and his sons, designated high priest, one of them. Certainly not the high priest's family and the other priests. Assuredly not the priests and Levites. Certainly not the members of the other tribes. Assuredly not the Gentiles. But into that place went the high priest alone. Once in the year. Nor only that. When he got there, what did he accomplish? Well, at least, says Hebrews, nothing so great as to make it unnecessary for him to go again the following year. The following year he had to go again. Year after year. The law, says Hebrews quite categorically, made nothing perfect. In those sacrifices there is a remembrance made of sins every year. A remembrance, but not an extinction. A bringing to mind of our sinfulness, but not a cure for it. Just the fact that we need it, but not the supply of the need. And even that high priest, go he in 1 year, 5, 10, 20, 40, for as long as he lives. When he dies, someone else must take his place. So not only one day only, year after year. And year after year, rather than once only. And priest after priest, rather than just one priest. In all those ways, says the letter to the Hebrews, the great Day of Atonement reveals how little can be accomplished by sacrifice alone. And when in that chapter in Hebrews he points out that now the Lord Jesus Christ, once, by his own blood, once and for all by his own blood, has gone into the most holy place there to make reconciliation for us, and dismisses the very idea that Christ should need to have suffered often from the foundation of the world in favour of something which done once will never need or be capable of being done again. He shows that what the shadow could point to, repeatedly point to, was in the work of the Lord Jesus Christ done once and for all, and would never need to be done again. In two letters at least in the New Testament, things are said about the admittedly holy and just and good law that came from God. We showed how well the writers of those books under God's hand recognized the limitations of what the law could do. Paul, describing it to the Galatians, criticizes them, even condemns them, certainly condemns their misleaders for turning back again to, and I quote, the weak and beggarly elements. come back. Which of us would dare to describe the sacrificial law in that way, as consisting of weak and beggarly elements? But Paul did. Those were the words in which he sought to display to the Galatians the vanity of what they were returning to. If the Gentiles among them allowed themselves to march in line with the Jews amongst them and go back to the temple and renew their worship there. The rudiments of the world, he called them, and condemned their continued observance. They had done their job, and the job needed doing. The law was our child leader to lead us unto Christ. But now, having been led to Christ, you may not say that for salvation a man needs to follow Christ, but also to follow the temple ordinances. Christ is the end of the law to everyone that believeth. And if the weak and beggarly elements of Galatians are the strongest expression of the inadequacy of the things of the law, then from the weakness and unprofitableness thereof, in Hebrews, runs it a close second. Hebrews is concerned to show that if one goes back to finding substance in offering animal sacrifices, or in honouring an earthly priest, or in going close to a material most holy place, when what has now been done is before our eyes, then he would need to say to us, O foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you, before whose eyes Jesus Christ is evidently set forth, crucified amongst you. What the law, and in many cases with great success, I have no doubt, taught the faithful in Israel for all the ages beyond was that there was a Saviour to come, to whom their faithful sacrifices would show that they too were willing to be pointed. What the new covenant shows is that we now have access by blood that speaketh better things than that of Abel. By his own blood, by the entered in once into the most holy place, through a high priest who is not of the Aaron line, not mortal, not actively sinful, not needing to have atonement made for himself for his constant sins, but holy and just and good. And Abel, having gone once into God's presence by his death into the heavens, to stay there. Greatest of all the contrasts between what the law pointed forward to, emphasizing as it must its limitations, and what the Lord achieved in fulfilling it, is that their high priest not only must not go except when bidden, and must go year after year when bidden, and must bid his sons go, but when he or they got there in the most holy place, stay only for what I think is an undefined time, it must have been short, minutes rather than days, and then come away again, having found no place to lay his head. The most holy place had the cherubim of glory, the Ark of the Covenant, and a mercy seat. But man did not sit down upon the mercy seat. That was the seat of the glory of God. The high priest stood, and still standing, walked out again, not to return save for another year under commandment. But this man, our great high priest, the priest after the order of Melchizedek, fulfills to the letter what David had prophesied about him, when he said, The Lord said unto my Lord, Sit thou at my right hand until I make thy foes thy footstool. But this man, says Hebrews, having once and for all made his offering for sin, is sat down at the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers being made subject to him. The Lord went through a ruptured veil to the throne of the Almighty in the heavenly throne of grace and made himself at home there. Such is the one whom we approach in what will follow.